Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Craig Moskowitz, and to begin our conversation, I asked him to summarize the most important recent clinical research developments in Hodgkin lymphoma.
I think that basically there are three things that have happened in the last couple of years. The first is the research with brentuximab vedotin. The second is some of the large European studies that have used chemotherapy alone in a PAD-adapted approach to try to eliminate radiation therapy for early-stage Hodgkin lymphoma. And the third thing that has happened is that there has been a fairly large push through the international community to do very large studies in advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma, which will be both European and American based. Some are PET adapted and some incorporate brentuximab vedotin as part of primary therapy. To me, the most important study is a study called the RAPID study. This was presented now twice by John Radford from the British National Lymphoma Study Group. And it includes most of the patients with early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, not the best and not the worst, but the majority of patients with early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, non-bulky. And what they did was they gave three cycles of ABVD chemotherapy to the patients, and then they repeated the PET scan. If the PET scan was still positive, they gave one more cycle of ABVD followed by radiation. That was only seen 20% of the time. In the remaining 80% of the time, if the PET scan was negative, there was a random assignment to get no further treatment versus radiation. It's a 700-patient study, and in the randomized cohort, 91% of the patients who got chemotherapy alone, so only 3 months of chemotherapy, which is half the amount that we used to give, have done well. And those patients who got the additional radiation therapy were at between 95 and 96%. So the bottom line is, in that patient population, which is the majority of non-bulky early-stage Hodgkin lymphoma without B symptoms, over 90% of the patients can be cured with 3 months of chemotherapy. That will be practice-changing when that's published. So that's the first thing.
Let me just ask what you're doing in your own practice in that regard.
Outside of a study, in that exact patient population, we're actually comfortable using that approach. The study that we have that's open, which I'm running, is actually for patients with actually bulky stage 2 Hodgkin lymphoma and unfavorable early stage Hodgkin lymphoma. So about half of that particular patient population, and we're giving four cycles of AVD and brentuximab vedotin, followed by a low dose of radiation. The reason that we're doing that is brentuximab vedotin has never been given sequentially with radiation. We have to make sure that that is actually safe to do to patients. Once that pilot study is done, which is 30 patients, I'm probably going to lead a multi-center study of four cycles of AVD and brentuximab vedotin plus or minus radiation therapy for patients with bulky stage 2 Hodgkin lymphoma to try to eliminate radiation therapy from all aspects of early stage Hodgkin lymphoma. So that's the study that we're doing that's open now. That has four patients on it, just opened. But outside of a study, I am using the RAPID approach, and many of us are using the RAPID approach for non-bulky early stage Hodgkin lymphoma.
And you also refer to other things that have happened, particularly the evolution of B-vedotin. Can you kind of capsulize that?
Yeah, sure. So this is, I've been involved since the phase one. So this is in early 2009. And clearly, it's the best drug that I've ever seen in Hodgkin lymphoma. And I would say most of the experts would agree that that's true. I participated in a lot of the early phase studies for a variety of reasons, the least of which is I wrote the Athera study, which is the largest study that will ever be done in relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma. The study's finished. All the patients with relapsed and refractory disease underwent a stem cell transplant. And then post-transplant, there's a placebo-controlled random assignment trial of 16 doses of brentuximab vedotin versus nothing. The study is finished. If that's a positive study, all patients who get transplanted for Hodgkin lymphoma will get a year of B-vedotin. So I did that study, and then we've also just nearly finished a salvage study of single-agent brentuximab vedotin. So this is where it's not approved for. This is for patients in first relapse. And we actually gave it weekly as opposed to the label dose, which is every 3 weeks. We give it weekly times three, off for a week, and then weekly times three, and repeated the patient's PET scan. And this is novel because if the PET scan is negative, we actually are not giving any salvage chemotherapy. So no ICE, no DHAP, no GEMOX. The patients just get their stem cells collected and they go to transplant. So we're actually trying to reduce treatment prior to a stem cell transplant. There was a variety of reasons to do that, but I'm actually convinced it's the salvage chemotherapy that causes the infertility and many of the other problems that we see. And it's actually probably not the transplant treatment. So that study has got 43 patients on it, 5 patients left to go. We presented some data at Lugano. We're going to present at ASH again. And then the last study, which it's not my favorite study, but it will be potentially practice changing. We're participating in it. It's a randomized study for patients with advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma, where patients are getting 6 months of ABVD versus 6 months of AVD and brentuximab vedotin. And that's sort of to see if we're going to change primary therapy. The reason I don't love it is because it's not separated out by prognostic groups. You know, ABVD has been around since 1974, so it's going to be a big hill to climb for the experimental arm to be practice changing, but we'll see what happens. So those three things are actually important to practicing physicians. Basically, changing the management of early stage Hodgkin lymphoma, changing the management of advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma, and looking at post-transplant maintenance therapy with a novel drug, I think is unique. Obviously, the cost of BV is an issue, but if it's going to markedly improve the outcome, it'll be a non-issue.
Anything new in terms of toxicity with bevacizumab, particularly neurotoxicity, both in terms of research reports as well as your own clinical observation?
Well, I think a couple of things have emerged. One thing has emerged fairly recently, but the issue with progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, or PML, has been seen with almost all antibody-based treatments. There's been about 4 or 5 cases of PML in patients reported to have received brentuximab vedotin. I'm not convinced that it's causally related because the patients are all fairly heavily pretreated. However, if somebody in any of these early stage studies would get PML, that would be a major problem for the drug. More importantly, however, and I'm not concerned about PML, quite frankly. More importantly, though, there's been some recent evidence that brentuximab vedotin has been associated with pancreatitis. There's been a letter that's just gone out to all the investigators. It's public knowledge that there's been roughly 5 to 10 cases of pancreatitis seen on some of the research studies. Now, I'm not so sure that this should be a dramatic shock, since we do know that vincas are associated with pancreatitis. The taxanes have been associated with pancreatitis. So there's now been some cases of pancreatitis seen with an antibody-drug conjugate that uses a, you know, mitotic spindle inhibitor. So I think that's real. And whether or not there is going to be some additional monitoring for folks getting bevacizumab on study is unclear. But these are real pancreatitis cases. Patients were hospitalized. And I'm not sure about if there's been any mortality.
Just getting back to PML for a second, what's the thinking in terms of the mechanism of how this occurs?
Well, you know, PML, as you know, was originally described in lymphoma patients who were markedly immune suppressed. And then it was subsequently described in HIV patients. Clearly, it's a T cell defect. And I do know of one patient in this cohort who actually had a CD4 count of 4. Do we know why he had that? We do not know why he had that. But I do believe it's related to prolonged immune suppression and a T cell defect.
What about the peripheral neuropathy? In your own experience, when do you see it? Is it reversible when you stop it? How bad is it? What's it like?
Well, in general, I think that it's unusual to be more than grade 1. In every case that I have taken care of, it's been reversible. I have one patient, and this is actually an important teaching point. I have actually one patient with pre-existing diabetes who has persistent grade 3 neuropathy. And I do wonder if somebody has a concomitant non-chemotherapy-related neuropathy, or even if they have a history of getting cisplatinum and they have grade 1 or 2 peripheral neuropathy, this may not be the smartest drug to give because it's probably not going to be reversible in that setting.
In your own practice, outside a protocol setting, how are you using bevedotin in Hodgkin's?
I use it on label. I use it for patients who are post-transplant failures, but I also use it for patients who are transplant ineligible. So if we have a 74-year-old guy with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma, the person is not transplant eligible, you can use it on label in first relapse. That's a kind of a little known fact, but folks think that you need to give these patients multi-agent chemotherapy. And in reality, the drug is actually approved to be given for patients in first relapse who are transplant ineligible. My gut feeling, though, is within a year, bevedotin will be approved for patients as part of salvage treatment.
And what's your experience been in terms of the benefits observed in these patients treated in first relapse?
In our data, on the clinical trial, the combination of bevedotin sequentially with ICE, what we reported in Lugano a couple of weeks ago, was that 85% of the patients were in remission at the time of transplant. And that we have not seen before. Now, most of the patients did not achieve a PET negative state with bevedotin alone, only a third. But the sequential treatment has been remarkable, and actually with little toxicity other than rash. So bevedotin causes a rash when given by itself in patients who are not heavily pretreated. And this has also been seen in the City of Hope experience. The rash is a typical drug rash, similar to a Bactrim or allopurinol rash.
And what do you do about it?
Sometimes the patients need to get steroids. We treat through it, though.
What about other novel agents, mTOR inhibitors, lenalidomide, IMIDs?
Yeah, I'm most excited about the PD-1 inhibitors, actually. You know, both mediastinal large cell lymphoma and Hodgkin lymphoma are probably thymic-derived, and they uniformly express PD-L1. So there's a couple of studies out there. I'm going to be a co-PI of a study, and that will be a preferential Hodgkin lymphoma study drug for us. So we're excited about that. We studied idelalisib in Hodgkin lymphoma. We were underwhelmed with that. We have a study that's open right now with romidepsin and lenalidomide, which is patients with Hodgkin lymphoma are eligible, and most of the patients with Hodgkin lymphoma are responding to that. Lenalidomide itself, I've not had much luck with, but it doesn't surprise me that romidepsin, which is an HDAC inhibitor, which we know is active in Hodgkin lymphoma from the panobinostat data, that combination may be beneficial. So we are treating patients on study with those two drugs with Hodgkin lymphoma. Those are the two that we're most interested in, PD-1 and the Romi-Rev study.
In terms of PD-1, have there been any patients treated, any responses observed?
That's a little too soon to tell. I think there are patients on study who are getting protracted doses of PD-1. That doesn't mean they're responding, but they are on drug.
So let's talk about the cases you brought here today, beginning with your 42-year-old lady.
Yeah, so this is a patient who I saw fairly recently. She's a pharmacist who is maybe a month postpartum, developed shortness of breath. She had a chest x-ray and was found to have a mediastinal mass. Obviously, you can now backdate this quite a ways, and she had been complaining during her pregnancy of shortness of breath, but it was felt that was probably just related to being pregnant, obviously. After she delivered and the imaging studies, she was found to have an 8-centimeter anterior mediastinal mass. That then led to the appropriate workup, and she had a biopsy showing classical Hodgkin lymphoma. She has active B symptoms, so she was really stage 2B. And the options for her, she would have been a person who had been ineligible for the rapid study because she had B symptoms. And so the options for her were to get 6 months of chemotherapy with ABVD or to get 4 months of chemotherapy followed by involved field radiation. And she is 42, so her risk of getting secondary breast cancer is no larger than the general patient population. So pretty much women older than the age of 35 who have a mass greater than 7 centimeters, I usually do recommend combined modality treatment for. So that's what was recommended, but because we have an open study of AVD and brentuximab vedotin followed by involved site radiation therapy, she enrolled in that study. She received her first dose last week, and so far so good. So off study, I would have offered her combined modality therapy. If, however, she was 22 with the same presentation, I likely would have offered her 6 months of chemotherapy alone. because then her risk of getting a secondary malignancy is probably 100-fold. The way her mass is growing, it's quite in the midline, and it is certainly conceivable that the inner aspect of her left breast could be radiated. So I would not offer that to a 22-year-old. Anything greater than 10 centimeters, you know, you have to do what you need to do. But what's interesting is that we have some recent data that we presented at Lugano, and one of the fellows is publishing, where we looked at 230 patients with early stage Hodgkin lymphoma. And what we did was we reconfigured, because now I'm sure you know, when you get a CAT scan, you get the traditional CAT scan in the axial images, but it can be reconfigured for coronal images as well. And no one knows if it's important if you have a coronal bulk versus transverse bulk. And actually, we did a fairly large study. It turns out for us, any mass greater than 7 centimeters coronally or transversely is considered bulky by our standards. So we presented this at Lugano. We spoke to the Princess Margaret group and MD Anderson group and the Johns Hopkins group. They're going to give us a large series of patients that we'll reconfigure coronally and see if we can redefine tumor bulk. So that's an ongoing project. So she just started her treatment and we'll see what happens.
Why don't we go into your next case? This is a patient with mantle cell lymphoma with prior Hodgkin lymphoma.
We'll talk about this in two different aspects. So this is a 65-year-old guy who presented with Hodgkin lymphoma in an outside center. We did confirm the pathology. He got ABVD chemotherapy, achieved a remission. However, his platelet count always remained quite low. It was felt that he had ITP. A workup was not robust. He developed some adenopathy and had a needle biopsy that was consistent with lymphoma, unclear what it was. They referred him to me, and then I sent him to get a excisional biopsy of a lymph node, and that showed mantle cell lymphoma. And we did a typical mantle cell lymphoma workup where he had bone marrow studies and GI tract studies, and he actually has widespread mantle cell lymphoma. There's no evidence of Hodgkin lymphoma. So he came to me actually because they thought he had relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma and he'd be eligible for one of our brentuximab vedotin studies. In reality now, he's got mantle cell lymphoma having previously been treated with 6 months of ABVD. So if he was untreated, he could have been eligible for, there is a study that will be approved fairly soon, which is bendamustine rituximab plus or minus ibrutinib for untreated mantle cell lymphoma patients who are transplant ineligible. He's really not a transplant candidate, but he's ineligible for that because of the antecedent Hodgkin lymphoma. So I decided to give him bendamustine and rituximab, which he received last week. And the plan is to give him 6 months of that. And there is evidence in the literature and was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, albeit with CHOP chemotherapy, that patients benefit for 2 years of rituximab maintenance after primary therapy for mantle cell lymphoma. So that's what I'm going to recommend. But if he was study eligible, I would have recommended the randomized study.
Am I correct in saying that the trial looked at, the European trial looking at maintenance R and mantle cell actually used it until progression and not for 2 years?
Oh, it is still progression.
And so that's what he's going to get?
Yeah, it's still progression. I think that in general, you know, the patients, as you get further and further along, there's really two patient populations, those that just can't wait to stop and those that are afraid to ever stop. And, you know, whenever I give a lecture on this, your patient physician time has gone from 6 months to 30 months at 2 years. So you've gone from seeing the patients maybe 4 or 5 times in that 30-month period, and now you've seen the patients close to 20 times. And it's actually a big deal for these patients coming in and out. And I'm always concerned about getting recurrent infections. But I must say, though, I do work this out with the patient. If the patient really is uncomfortable stopping, then I won't stop. If the patient is having infections, I always stop. If the patient has hypogammaglobulinemia with no infection, I usually stop at 2 years. So I think it is a little bit artsy, I must say. But I'm sure, as you know, this is not follicular lymphoma where we have sort of many, many things to do. It is mantle cell lymphoma. But we're going to get a couple of new drugs very soon with mantle cell lymphoma. Ibrutinib is on the fast track to get approved for mantle cell lymphoma and for Waldenstrom's. I think that's likely going to happen. ABT-199 is very active in mantle cell lymphoma, which is the BCL-2 inhibitor. So that's another very active drug. And IPI-145 may have activity in mantle cell lymphoma. So even though we have very few drugs that are approved, you know, we have bortezomib and we have a few other things. I think bortezomib has moved way down on the list for patients to get therapy for mantle cell lymphoma. And in fact, lenalidomide has moved way up on the list. Lenalidomide got approved 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago for mantle cell lymphoma. And lenalidomide is certainly much easier to give than bortezomib. So one can almost even imagine folks coming up with lenalidomide ibrutinib-based treatments. That sounds interesting. One can imagine giving bendamustine and rituximab. And if the patient still has, let's say they have a PR, instead of giving rituximab maintenance, maybe you'll give lenalidomide and rituximab maintenance. I think these are coming. I think it's quite rational, actually, to do things like that. So, you know, in 1994-3, when I started, we didn't even know this was a disease. When we found out it was a disease, the median survival was 3 years. Probably the median survival of mantle cell lymphoma now is 10 years. And you wonder, with the addition of these novel agents, if really what we've done is we've converted mantle cell lymphoma to follicular lymphoma, but you're 7 or 8 years behind. Because with follicular lymphoma now, the median survival is approaching 15, 16, 17 years. So you got to think of who gets mantle cell lymphoma. Mantle cell lymphoma, the median age is 64. It's 5 times more common in men. Now you're going to have all these new drugs that we're going to be giving to these older men. And quite frankly, you know, a 78-year-old guy is probably going to have some other things. So they're going to have mantle cell lymphoma with concomitant other treatments. So I think we need to keep that in mind. I think that patients are going to be living with mantle cell lymphoma while being treated for other things as well. And that's only a good thing, I think.
How do you approach the younger patient with mantle cell?
So we transplant everybody in first remission. We give doxorubicin-based treatment for 4 cycles. That's followed by high-dose Ara-C-based treatment. We used to give ICE consolidation, but there's very strong evidence from the European Mantle Cell Lymphoma Consortium that the addition of Ara-C improves survival. So we give Ara-C-based treatment, and that's followed by a transplant. We actually have a study where the patients get I-131 tocetubimab with high-dose chemotherapy as part of our study here. There are other studies that are being done throughout the United States, but almost all of them end in a transplant. And there is a push right now through the cooperative groups to see if we can give ibrutinib as maintenance after a upfront transplant for mantle cell lymphoma. And we'll see where that's going. That's with the powers that be right now.
Fascinating. Anything else you want to say about mantle cell that we haven't talked about?
Yeah, I think mantle cell lymphoma is, even today we have learned that ABT-199, which is really quite a drug, there has been tumor lysis with mantle cell lymphoma, which is hard to imagine intuitively because it's not a disease that rapidly progresses. And it's generally a disease that's not in leukemic phase, although it can be in leukemic phase. Patients normally have an elevated LDH. It's diffuse adenopathy, which is generally non-bulky. But with this drug, there has been tumor lysis with mantle cell lymphoma. So it looks like it's going to be an avenue of another drug that's going to get a home in this disease. I'm very impressed with that. I'm also equally impressed with the lack of benefit of idelalisib in mantle cell lymphoma, which is kind of surprising, where the drug has very good activity in follicular lymphoma, but this PI3 kinase delta inhibitor has no activity in mantle cell lymphoma. And in fact, they stopped development with that subtype of lymphoma, which is peculiar. So I'm excited about that disease, and for a variety of reasons, but it is actually the most common consult that we see, even though it's not a common lymphoma, only 6,000 cases or so each year. After diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, it's the most common lymphoma we see at Memorial, because patients are referred all the time because of, you know, the difficulty of, it's really the historical difficulty with the disease. But certainly as we get these new drugs, this is going to be a disease that's going to be treated in the community. And this is going to be a disease that patients are going to be doctored fairly heavily because therapy is going to be chronic.
Any comments on the side effects and toxicities with ibrutinib and alpelisib?
Well, ibrutinib can cause a little bit of diarrhea. I've seen almost nothing with ibrutinib. Idelalisib clearly causes liver function test abnormalities. And it is a problem on study because the patients have to be held once there is grade 3 AST and ALT abnormalities. So I am convinced that that drug is going to get approved in follicular lymphoma, idelalisib. It's quite active. I mean, it's a quite active drug from the recent data from Lugano and ASCO. And it's definitely going to need to be some vigilance with LFTs. It's not going to be a drug that you're going to tell the patient, here, take the drug and I'll see you in a month. I don't think that that's going to happen. You're actually going to have to monitor liver function tests for these folks. So for someone like me, I don't really care. I mean, I'll get the studies done. But for a very busy practitioner, all of a sudden getting weekly LFTs and SMA20s on all these patients, they're going to have to be up to that and knowing when to hold the drug and not to hold the drug.
There have been a number of papers coming out recently looking at combinations with these two agents, rituximab, bendamustine, et cetera, everolimus. What's your global take on this? Looking at that, I wasn't clear that it was that much better. Of course, you can't really tell, or if it was even better.
Well, I mean, I think that let's just think of what the patient populations are now, and then let's see what they're going to be. Right now, all the patients basically have had God knows how many doses of rituximab, and they're clearly rituximab refractory. I mean, if you have had, you're on your fourth treatment for follicular lymphoma, you probably have had 20 doses of rituximab. So it doesn't surprise me that the addition of rituximab and a novel agent is not all that great in patients heavily pretreated. But it's critical to see what the results are to make sure that there's not additive toxicity because the drugs are going to be moved up in the armamentarium and they're going to be combined with an anti-CD20 drug. So I would guess that a rituximab ibrutinib or a rituximab adalimumab study in patients who are rituximab sensitive in first relapse of follicular lymphoma, I would think that the combination treatment is going to be better than the single agent alone.
I want to ask you about your last case, but another question I'm curious what your thoughts on, if you have any, you're talking about an anti-CD20, was a paper from ASCO looking at obinutuzumab. I think it used to be called GA101. Any thoughts about that?
You know, it's sad to say, but I am underwhelmed with all the new anti-CD20s. I think that there are many, and there are biosimilars coming as well. I don't know if that's going to make the U.S. that quickly, but certainly in Europe, that's coming. A biosimilar of rituximab. There is minimal improvement over what we have now with rituximab alone. And there's a little bit of improvement with GA101 in CLL. So there's a big, huge CLL study that was presented by the German CLL Consortium, which compared chlorambucil to chlorambucil and rituximab to chlorambucil and GA101. And the bottom line is the chlorambucil alone arm closed. Both the anti-CD20 arms were superior. And now they are expanding the numbers of patients in those two cohorts to see if there is a improvement in one arm or the other. If indeed, in CLL, if indeed the GA101 cohort is superior, I do think that it will be an avenue for approval for the drug. In lymphoma, I'm much more skeptical that any of these new anti-CD20s are anything better than rituximab alone.
Well, it seems like in lymphoma, it's a greater challenge because rituximab has more activity than CLL. But, you know, I had that same impression that you did in terms of, you know, sort of Me Too type thing until I saw that paper. And I understand that, you know, sort of technically, you can't compare the GA101 chlorambucil arm to the rituximab chlorambucil arm, you know, until it has more statistical power. But just looking at those numbers indirectly, it looked like a big difference.
It does look better.
Am I missing something?
No argument here. It looks markedly better.
I mean, it looks to me like it's better enough that if it holds up, it's going to be used.
Yeah, it's going to be used. But we got to remember that this is at a time when both idelalisib and ibrutinib are steamrolling. They're moving along, right?
Yeah, but I mean, that's not going to change the fact that you need an anti-CD20 in there, most likely.
Yes, that's probably true. But the other thing that's important is that, you know, the antibody drug conjugates are hot. We have the phase 1 anti-CD19 antibody drug conjugate study open for lymphoma du jour. The anti-CD79A study that Roger Advani did looks pretty good. I just think that oncologists, you know, psychologically will much more likely go to an antibody drug conjugate second after they failed a naked antibody first. I don't think they're going to go from naked antibody to naked antibody.
Let's talk about your last patient.
So this is a long-term patient of mine, typical. A patient I had with follicular lymphoma, monitored her for 3 years, and then she developed a rapidly growing axillary mass, which showed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So she had a transformed lymphoma. I treated her with R-CHOP 21 to remission, and then I put her on 2 years of maintenance rituximab, which I do for everybody with a transformed lymphoma. As soon as her first restaging after the 2 years of maintenance therapy, she developed widespread adenopathy. I was concerned for her large cell lymphoma, actually. She wanted to go away for the summer. It was a wedding in the family. We saw her about 3 months later. We repeated the imaging studies. They were sort of stable. We repeated a biopsy, and she once again had her follicular lymphoma came back. So this is a patient who just pretty much recently had 16 doses of rituximab. And now 6 months after her last dose of rituximab has now got widespread follicular lymphoma. So she was a very good study candidate, and she's a young patient. She certainly could have been somebody who've gotten bendamustine-based treatment. She's somebody who could have gotten treatment with lenalidomide, likely with rituximab, although I was not keen on giving rituximab. Our study we had open, which was certainly the easiest to do, is with a drug called IPI-145, which is a PI3 kinase gamma delta inhibitor. So it's different than idelalisib, which is just a delta inhibitor. It's also an oral agent. Does have a similar side effect profile as does idelalisib. Can cause LFT abnormalities, can cause a rash, just like those drugs. Why do we need a gamma delta inhibitor? Well, that's a very good question. There are those who say that the gamma chain may, at least in patients with blood-based lymphomas and leukemias, there was a more rapid drop in the white count. It's unclear. We are studying this drug for a variety of reasons. It looks like it's got activity in T-cell lymphoma. And this is a study that allows all types of lymphoma. So we put her on IPI-145. She's now just started her third month of treatment. So she's had her first restaging, and she's basically had a clinical complete response. And she's thrilled.
So looking back on this case, what do you think was happening? Do you think that, you know, you sort of got rid of the diffuse large B-cell component or the transformed component, and then the follicular came back?
Well, I think that's what happened. I mean, I think that if the large cell lymphoma came back, she would have had to have a stem cell transplant. Now I think we're still in a territory where she can get novel treatment. If, for example, she has a nice response to this study drug and 3 months later her disease starts coming back, then we'll have to think of a more aggressive approach. She is a young woman. She's in her early 50s, so she may very well go down that pathway.
So let's talk a little bit about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma the last year or two in terms of important research reports and new strategies that are coming out. What's new?
You know, well, the key things, as you know, is that diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is not considered one disease anymore. It's considered at least three different diseases: primary mediastinal large B-cell lymphoma, the activated B-cell subtype of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and the most common, which is the dermal center-derived diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Paradoxically, the most common is the one that does the best with treatment, although if the first treatment doesn't work, it does equally as poorly as any of the other treatments. But because the ABC subtype does the worst with standard R-CHOP, there's been a lot of research that's gone on looking at adding targeted therapy to this subtype of large cell lymphoma. Most of the work comes from Lou Stout's group. And sort of the end of the day, the NF-kappa-B pathway is overexpressed in the ABC subtype. And proximal to NF-kappa-B, there is a variety of genetic abnormalities that can happen. But NF-kappa-B is turned on by stimulating the B-cell receptor. So inhibitors of the B-cell receptor or drugs that inhibit genes distal to the B-cell receptor are what's being studied. And in fact, the ones that are likely most interesting is ibrutinib. Ibrutinib is a BTK inhibitor that has selective activity in the ABC subtype. There's a phase 1-2 study which we participated in with the NCI and a few other centers that showed a 45% response rate to a single drug with the ABC subtype of large cell lymphoma and no activity in any of the other subtypes of large cell lymphoma. That has led to a huge random assignment trial, which is being initiated. We're actually leading the study at Memorial. Honest Unis is leading the study of R-CHOP plus or minus ibrutinib for the ABC subtype of large cell lymphoma. A second thing that has come along, which I am surprised about, is that actually brentuximab vedotin has a 50% response rate in CD30-positive diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which is about 20% of the patient population. That may or may not be leading to a random assignment trial in CD30-positive diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, similar to the ibrutinib study. Thirdly, there is a gene that is abnormal in 10% of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which is CD79A, which can be mutated. Novartis has an antibody against CD79A. So that's being studied fairly extensively as a single agent. It's seeing only 10% of the time in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, but if the mutation is there, it makes sense to give that targeted drug. And the pathway is really so complicated that if certain genes are turned on, then certain drugs will work. And if genes are turned off, certain drugs will not work. But it is a robust pathway that's being studied to the point that Foundation Medicine, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, which is a company out of Boston, originally part of the Broad Institute, recently started doing mutational analysis on some solid tumor patients, sarcoma, and a few other tumors, looking at mutations to certain genes, which can lead then to targeted therapy. And Foundation Medicine has recently partnered with Memorial for looking at doing mutational analyses for liquid tumors. And the first of these to start is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And we are doing a large cohort study where tissue samples are being sent to Foundation Medicine, and we will get back a mutational pathway, which is going to be presented at ASH. So, for example, a patient has diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and it is an ABC subtype. Mutational analysis is going to be done in this B-cell receptor pathway. And in fact, we now know if there is a mutation in CORD11, which is distal to BTK, ibrutinib has no activity. So you would probably want to know that before you gave ibrutinib. So those type of things are going to be coming. It's the real world. So this is, I think, very exciting. In large cell lymphoma, I think that that is two large random assignment studies that are being done. The third is the French are doing a random assignment trial of R-CHOP plus or minus lenalidomide with lenalidomide maintenance in the ABC subtype of large cell lymphoma. So that's ongoing.
I guess that's the so-called R-squared CHOP.
The R-squared CHOP, correct.
And that has, it looks like, again, in the ABC subtype, pretty encouraging response data.
Oh, it looks very good. It looks very good. But you have to understand, these are very big commitments for the companies because you're well aware there's a recently 800-patient randomized study with enzostorin, which was a bust, which is totally negative. So Peter Johnson from the British National Lymphoma Study Group is doing a very novel study where the patients get a biopsy prior to treatment, gene expression profiling is being done, and as the patient has an ABC subtype, they're getting R-CHOP plus bortezomib, which is also an NF-kappa-B inhibitor. And the turnaround time is only 2 weeks to get the results back.
You mentioned bevedotin in diffuse large B-cell. What's your recommendation to the doc in practice in terms of ordering CD30 in diffuse large B-cell?
Routine. should be retained?
Up front or only on relapse?
All. Because up front, CD30 positive, CD20 positive diffuse large B-cell lymphoma may actually have some prognostic implications. So for us, it's part of the standard panel.
What about other B-cell cancers?
It's seen in 95% of primary mediastinal large cell lymphoma, CD30 positive disease. In the other B-cell cancers, in low-grade lymphoma, it doesn't make much sense.
Can you comment a little bit on response-adapted therapy using interim PET scans and where that is?
Well, I mean, response-adapted therapy has got a home in Hodgkin lymphoma, certainly. Patients who get ABVD for two cycles who have a negative PET scan have a 90% cure rate with ABVD. And if the PET scan is positive, they have a 30% cure rate if you continue the ABVD. So that's a very wide splay in the curve. In diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, patients who have an interim negative PET scan have about an 80% cure rate. The problem is if the PET scan is positive, the cure rate is between 45 and 60%. We generally don't recommend doing an interim PET in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma off study. Despite that, everybody gets it. So my advice is if you get it, you have to have some idea of what you're going to do with the information. It's likely going to be negative because it is negative 3/4 of the time. I would recommend a CAT scan anyway in the mid-treatment. But that not being said, the new response criteria is coming. And there is going to be PET all over the new NCCN guidelines and all over the new third generation of the CHESN or the International Harmonization Criteria. There is going to be a lot of PET imaging. And the real question is, do we actually need to be doing CT imaging, especially on treatment? Do we need to do actually a contrast-enhanced CAT scan if we're going to do a PET scan? And the answer to that is likely not, unless you're considering doing radiation therapy as part of your treatment.
In what situations right now, outside of a trial setting, will you use something other than R-CHOP up front for diffuse large B-cell?
Outside of a study, I give dose-adjusted R-EPOC for primary mediastinal lymphoma. And I give dose-adjusted R-EPOC for patients who have the unfortunate lymphomas that overexpress c-MYC, or the double-hit lymphomas, which are very prognostically unfavorable. So the recommendation is either to transplant those patients in first remission off study, or to give them dose-adjusted or EPOC. So those clearly, I think, are two standard treatments that we give EPOC for. I think that something that I always like to tell folks is that once you're older than 70, you have one chance to be cured with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And in fact, all the advances that we've seen with R-CHOP and changing of therapy is actually in the 60 to 80 age group. Most of the other things have been extrapolated to younger patients, but actually the big studies are all patients age 60 to 80. So I would argue that the patient who's in that age group, number one, they need to be treated standardly. Number two, they are the golden patient population for research studies. They are the patient population that community docs should be referring for R-CHOP ibrutinib, for R-CHOP brentuximab vedotin, for R-squared CHOP. This is who we're making an impact upon. Paradoxically, I think what happens is that the community physicians actually refer the younger patients in. And in fact, it's the younger patients where standard treatment is less well-defined. So we preferentially add these novel agents to the patients age 60 to 80 because they have one chance to be cured. So my plea is that this is the patient population to please refer in. Because, in fact, and if they're going not to get the investigational drug, likely the R-CHOP can be given by the community physician anyway. It's just the novel drug is free, so they need to come in for it. But that is a plea. The second plea is that in mantle cell lymphoma, I do believe that if the patient is older than 65, you should be committed to be giving maintenance therapy in remission. It's very important. We got to be practicing based upon random assignment trials that have been published in The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine. That's what the data is. It's important. And thirdly, and just to reiterate, interim PET scans for Hodgkin lymphoma will be standard of care with the next NCCN guidelines. So it's perfectly reasonable to do them. And it's perfectly reasonable to change therapy with guidance if you feel it's necessary if the PET scan is abnormal. So those, to me, are three big things.